radioalbion.com.
Well, that's the round table. We dance where we're able. We do routines and corner scenes to footwork in bed cable. We dine well here in Camelot. We eat ham and jam and spam a lot.
Hello and welcome to the Radio Albion Roundtable. Today's date is Monday the 25th of July 2022 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. It's been a little while since we've all got together for one of these and I am looking forward to today, as I am sure my co-hosts here are also looking forward to gathering round the round table and bringing our news stories for you, the listeners, to check out. And that is, of course, Grandpa Dan and Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson, who are here with me today. Grandpa, how are you doing, sir?
I'm so messed up on my days that when you started opening there, I really, my brain was processing. I was expecting you to say, welcome to the Daily Nationalist. And I was just fixing to get into that vibe, but it's even better. The boys are back in town once again doing the round table. Always great to sit around and have these discussions.
And Matt, Dr. Johnson, how are you doing? I'm very pleased that you're able to make it this morning. Are you looking forward to the show today?
Yeah, I really love the round tables. But to coin a phrase, I think my computer has both cancer and dementia. And they seem to feed on each other. So, look, if I drop out in the middle of this, you know exactly why. What a disaster. I just did a clean install of Windows 10, and so hopefully that fixes the problem.
Well, you may have some hardware issues. I think I got bitten by a tick last week and then caught COVID, and now I think one of my teeth is falling out as well. But I am here today to record this podcast, and we do have three really exciting news stories to bring to you, the listeners. The first one that we have here today is all about the racist white supremacy of forensic detective work. And this is something that I've been waiting for the left to jump on for quite some time now, because, of course, when you are looking at bones, all you need is a tiny scrap of bone, and these detectives can tell exactly what race that person is, exactly what ethnicity that person is, and what gender that person is. But, of course, now that gender is fluid and it's all about how you identify, how can we have such a thing as forensic detective work in 2022? Well, now there are people complaining about this and trying to put a stop to it all. Gender activists want scientists to stop categorizing ancient human remains as either male or female, because they cannot be sure how the deceased identified themselves when they were alive. So regardless of the fact that they are either male or female, we don't know quite what the person whose body it is that we're looking at 1,000 years ago, how they identified. So what are we supposed to call them? Just call them a human mass? Not even allowed to give them a race, apparently, here. Woke warriors have also insisted that archaeologists no longer categorize the race of remains, as this contributes to white supremacy. And of course, that's because when we look at remains from 2,000 years ago in Greece or any civilization, you find that it's white people, because white people built the civilization. And you'll find there is a dearth of black or non-white remains from that era. So they don't want you to identify race anymore either, because that excludes people that perhaps didn't have as much to do with civilization as white people did thousands of years ago. Critics said last night that such demands would lead to a rewriting of history and imposing current ideology where it doesn't belong. Traditionally, when human remains are excavated, archaeologists determine traits such as age, gender, and race using proven scientific methods such as bone structure and DNA analysis. This allows anthropologists and historians to learn more about the person and expand academic research. However, ancient skeletons are increasingly being labelled as non-binary or gender-neutral by trendy academics, and the Black Trowel Collective of American Anarchist Archaeologists says archaeologists must centre the fluidity of gender in their archaeological practice. And what he's essentially saying is that gender ideology has to trump science, basically. The group's manifesto on trans liberation states, it is clear from archaeological, historical, and ethnographical accounts that human gender is highly variable and that human beings have historically been comfortable with a range of genders beyond modern masculine and feminine binaries. Well, I think a thousand years ago, women could not afford to be anything other than women, and they needed men to protect them. Masculine and feminine is absolutely central to the whole of history, and to pretend otherwise is madness. Of course, we do have a sensible person here, Jeremy Black, Emeritus Professor of History at the University of Exeter. He said, "It is an absurd proposition, as the difference between genders, just as the difference between religious, social, and national groups, are key motors in history." He added, "This very ideological approach to knowledge means that we're in danger of making knowledge itself simply a matter of political preference." And that is essentially what's going on here. They're saying, because we haven't got lots of black people that are involved in this, we'll just have to say that it's no longer white people, it's diverse people, it's all peoples. We're having to, rather than actually being careful about the specific terminology that we're using and narrowing it down to exactly who it is we're talking about, we've just got to fudge things and say, oh, well, it's a human being. It's a non-binary human being. And it just means that we're in danger of losing all the knowledge that that we've come across over thousands of years. And this started with European researchers suggesting last year that thousand-year-old remains found in Finland belong to a non-binary person, because items found around the bones, such as a sword, suggested the person was male, whilst jewellery suggested the remains were female. I mean, but could it not have just been that the body itself had some jewellery there? I mean, it's either it's male or it's female. It's not a non-binary person because they had either a sword or jewellery there. The whole point of the matter is, it's what that body belongs to. Does it belong to a male? Does it belong to a female? And what ethnicity does it belong to? Frank Faridi, Emeritus Professor of Sociology at the University of Kent, warned that historical fact was becoming the latest frontier for advocates of radical gender ideology, adding, if you look at history, one of the foundations of civilization is the distinction between man and woman, whether it be in the Bible or yin and yang in Chinese philosophy. So when you distort that, you get a completely different version of what has happened. Should this dangerous dogma be accepted, it means that when children learn about Greek, Roman, or other ancient civilizations, they get a falsified picture. You have to fight back against this, because if it is accepted, then the whole academic enterprise turns into an empty pursuit of ideological objectives. A US study earlier this year urged scientists to stop the dangerous classifying of remains by race. The author said ancestry estimation contributes to white supremacy and might actually hinder identification efforts because of entrenched racial biases. And that is, again, that's basically just because when you're looking at history and you're looking at civilizations, it is disproportionately white people that were involved in building those civilizations. So the bodies that you're going to find are going to be white. And of course, they say, well, this leads to ideas of white supremacy, doesn't it? Well, it certainly leads to ideas that white people were responsible for building civilization. And of course, they don't want people to know that. They don't want white people to be proud of their history and proud of the things that we've done. So they want to try and hide this. I think that's what's going on here. Anyway, there's lots of things there that we can pick over. Matt, what are your thoughts on all of this? You're our resident academic. What do you think of what's going on here and this attack on academia?
Well, there's a reason I'm not at a university anymore, and this is part of the reason. Even if I had tenure somewhere, I couldn't function. I could hardly say anything. The most terrified group of people out there are white male academics, and what they do is they're always under attack. So the tiniest little thing will be taken as racism or something. So they are extremely leftist then. They go overboard. Firing white people in the office and, you know, to insulate themselves from any accusation because their career is over just with the accusation, whether there's evidence or not. Of course, your name will be plastered all over the university and all over the local press, at least. But to say, as that one man said, this is going to impose an ideology, inflexible ideology on archaeology, and that's why this new idea is a bad one. He kind of misses the point, because the people who are promoting this are well aware that this imposes an ideology. They're well aware that since, you know, truth doesn't exist, the only thing left is power. So that's actually the point. There is a war on reason itself, and you can't really use reason to attack reason. So this is one of the ways that power takes over, because now you can just rewrite history however you want. You can say that the genders don't matter because in ancient India there was an all-female army. Well, that's probably not true. It's definitely not true. But because you could say whatever, you can't affirm a gender in any remains. Well, what's wrong with saying that they're female then? So they can simply, you know, take each variable they want and fill it with their trendy ideology. And this is the Soviet Union was the exact same way. There was a Soviet physics, there was a Soviet biology, there was a Soviet sociology. And of course, the ideology of the party was imposed on it. And this is what happens when any foundation for weighing truth claims is taken away. And this isn't anything new. You know, this has been going on for decades now. Only recently does it have a media label. But they were talking about this when I was in grad school. And things tend to start in academia first as the most corrupt institution in society. And then slowly it filters its way to the rest of society. These people aren't used to hearing the word no. They're not used to not getting their way. So I think what's going to happen is that this is going to just slowly seep into research silently. And in a decade, it's going to be the norm. And then they're going to think this is always how it's been. That's really how these things tend to work. Conservatives will complain for a couple of years and then move on to another issue. The media won't bother covering anymore. It'll just become a fact of life. And I think you're right, Sven. And when I was editor of the Barnes Review, I think in almost every issue, we had an article from a specialist in the ancient or prehistoric worlds who spoke of white skeletons being found, whether it be in southern India or China or Central Africa, or, you know, having whites being here before the Indians in America. Kennewick Man, I believe it is. And that's what terrifies them. You know, Genghis Khan was of European background. All of the contemporary depictions and descriptions of him say he has red hair and gray eyes. Only centuries later did he start looking more and more Asian. This is happening everywhere. And, you know, Kennewick was just one big discovery which the Clinton administration destroyed precisely because of what it says. It says that whites were here before Indians were here. And as this becomes better and better known, I mean, academics, they specialize in this. They will come across it eventually. And it's going to destroy their entire regime. And this is why leftists in general are going to jump on this bandwagon, even though it might not be a public issue, so they can completely destroy this. Well, Kennewick Man, we don't know what he is because you can't tell race from bones. Well, you can tell race from anything. And that's really the issue here. Races are real. They're biological. They're a part of creation. And everything screams race. I don't care what the remains are. You could tell. There's patterns and everything else. And that's really the problem here. This is what Franz Boas assaulted many, many decades ago. So that means, you know, if you can't identify or refuse to identify remains as racial or gendered, then you have to implicitly accept that these are entirely social constructs with no foundation in biology at all. But, of course, we know that's not true. That's hence this whole issue. And I think it was just that one, just because it was one extreme group, these anarchists, doesn't mean that they're not mainstream. Doesn't mean they're not going to be listened to. This will be the norm in maybe 10 years, maybe less than that. So the ideology that's imposed on it is that biology is a meaningless science, unless, of course, it deals with evolution. But otherwise, it's a meaningless science because, at least when applied to race, gender, ethnicity, etc., because there can't be there aren't any, but there can't be any physical manifestations of race, gender, etc. In anything, let alone remains, let alone, you know, pottery and everything else you could find. And given the fact that in archaeology, this is, you know, 50% of what they're worried about, gender relations, relations among ethnicities. That's some of the major issues that they cover. One of the reasons that they dig up these places to begin with. And now that's going to be informally banned, or they'll simply make it up. So, and that's done on purpose. You know, they're not even hiding this very much. But just to say, oh, this is an ideology imposed on a science, that doesn't say anything. They're well aware of that. You have to go on and explain exactly why they're doing this, what their ideology is, and why competing truth claims simply don't exist anymore in their minds.
Well, it's like if they can remove race from everything, from these remains, if they can remove gender from these remains, so it's deracinated, degenderfied, it can just be anything. And once they've got you to accept that it can just be anything, then a few years down the line, they can project a different race onto it. And nobody can argue and say any different. And they could say that Genghis Khan was black because they've already taken race out of the question before then deciding that he is black. And of course, they generally try to tell us that race is a white supremacist classification that was dreamt up by the British Empire or dreamt up by Americans, and it's only existed for 200 years. So, of course, when they find proof that races and the idea of there being different races has been around for thousands of years, they have to come up with some way to negate that and destroy that, which is what they're doing here by saying that basically you cannot assign any race or gender to any remains that are found. And again, and also because it's completely subjective, because we don't know how that person might have identified. So what's the point in doing it anyway? I mean, it's just a complete destruction of all knowledge, isn't it? Grandpa, what are your thoughts on this new way of looking at forensic detective work?
My thoughts are that I have not finished my second cup of coffee. I don't know how well I'm prepared just for this vast amount of silliness early in the morning. I think I can go ahead and speak for all of us that we shouldn't have to listen to any leftist ever again talk about how much they love science. Can we just go ahead and agree on that? I mean, I don't ever want to hear anything about how, you know, religious people just chase around fairy tales, but they are superior. They have the moral high ground because, you see, I love science. I'm all about the science. But of course, eventually, if you're talking about actual science, it runs afoul of their fantasy world narratives that they create. So what's the answer? The answer is the same thing. It always is censorship. This is what we're talking about here. If they're saying they're not going to allow these archaeologists to look and say, oh, look, this was, I don't know, a sub-Saharan African female. If they're not going to, they're censoring them. They're going to force them to say, well, we don't know exactly what it is. Well, it all comes back to the censorship thing. And to kind of highlight one of the things Dr. Johnson was saying, this quote this guy made about this being in danger of making knowledge itself simply a matter of political preference. You know, as they say in computer language, that's a feature, not a bug. I mean, this isn't by any way, you know, by accident. Going back to the fact that they don't love science, you know, when you use the term race, especially in the context of a story like this, a better word to use perhaps would be genetics. So when they say that race doesn't exist, or you know, they want to pretend and act like race doesn't exist, or that it's nothing more than just, you know, skin color, it's just skin color. If you substitute the word race for genetics, it really shows how anti-actual science their position really is. Because if race was nothing more than just skin color, well, yeah, they're looking at a set of 2,000-year-old bones, aren't going to be able to tell what color their skin was, except that they can look at the other factors that make that person up and say this person was of European descent or of Asian descent, whatever. They can tell that. They can tell what gender they are. Once again, these people live in a fantasy world. They live in this bubble. And their answer when anything, you know, when reality comes knocking on their bubble and says, look here, I'm glaring you in the face, I'm staring at you, they just ignore it, and they demand that everybody else ignore it as well. Why they go along with this? It's the same reason why I would say it's the same reason, because you could say, why doesn't anybody, everybody always asks, you know, why do we act like, you know, this little group of people that says, oh, we've got to do this and we're outraged. Why does everybody act like they have to answer to that? How come nobody ever stands up and says, yeah, no, we don't care what you think. We're not going to do that. That's stupid. But yeah, that never happens. Everybody runs around and acts like, oh my gosh, we have to answer to this. Well, the answer is simply in a case such as this, I would say it's very much the same as why when you turn on your TV and you're looking at, I don't know, new Lincoln luxury automobile commercials, there's never any white people, even though their target consumer is going to be predominantly older white people. They're going to be like boomer white people, but yet it's all going to be young blacks. It's all going to be black people. Why is that? Well, because, you know, if they want to get the financing, if they want to, you know, they got to stay good with BlackRock, et cetera. So they've got to go along with the deal. It's nothing about selling cars. They've got to put the black people in there. Well, likewise, any of this stuff has to be funded. If you're doing an archaeological dig, a scientific study, whatever the case, whatever research you're doing, I mean, that money's got to come from somewhere. And you can bet that at the end of the day, if you don't get on board with the program, with the narrative, you're not going to get the funding. It's just that plain and simple. This is why in the end, we see these people run around and say, oh my gosh, this is bad. Oh, but we know that inevitably, this little group of whiners, the eternally outraged, as I like to call them, are going to, on some level or another, they're going to get their way. This also just, for these people, it's always about history started today. You know, they constantly attack history. You know, we see this. We've done multiple stories about this. But it always comes back to today is day zero of history. Nothing happened before. Nothing relevant happened. Doesn't matter what happened yesterday, much less last year, 10 years ago, 100 years ago. It's always today is day zero of history. We're starting all over, because if you're detached from that, then reality, it makes it easier to dictate that reality is whatever they say it is. And yeah, I mean, yeah, they do want to make knowledge a matter of political preference. That's like everything they're doing, everything we see going along. And just to kind of wrap up once again, for the umpteenth time, I've said it till I'm blue in the face. We see this term thrown around time and again, but you do notice they never actually give us a real definition of white supremacy. We wind up operating on guessing, you know, what they mean by that. But you notice these people never, they always throw that term around, white supremacy. But I have yet to see a single one of them ever actually break it down and give us a real working definition of it. And I'm willing to guess we're never actually going to see that, Sven.
Well, it's just a racialized insult, isn't it, to say white supremacy? And you're just talking about the funding there. And I had a look at this Black Trow Collective. They say any archaeology student, graduate or undergraduate who needs it can apply. Students of colour and students without parental or family support, or who lack access to other forms of financial aid by virtue of being undocumented, etc., to the front. So I guess they imagine that there are going to be lots of illegal immigrant archaeologists on their way across the channel. All these doctors and rocket scientists that we're told are making their way over here. We can now add archaeologists to that list. Well, Grandpa, I believe you've got a news article on Conservative Party leadership hopeful Liz Truss. I think you're a bit of a fan of Miss Truss, aren't you? You've mentioned her a few times, and now she's in the spotlight because she might well end up being our Prime Minister over here in Britain. Do you want to let us in on what you've been finding out about her?
Well, yeah, I mean, ever since the word came down that Boris Johnson was on the way out. I was an early supporter. I've been an early backer, a big cheerleader here for Liz Truss. Now, you may be wondering why. Why is that, Grandpa? Why would you support Liz Truss? Is it because she's obvious? I mean, just smoking hot. I mean, she's just amazing. But no, because because Liz Truss has got to be, you know, it's like as bad as Boris Johnson is, it's like we're on this decline of political quote unquote leadership in the West. And, you know, here in the U.S., obviously we have the dementia patient who's the figurehead president. But I mean, Liz Truss is so breathtakingly stupid that I absolutely support her becoming the next prime minister, because this is going to give us virtually unlimited comedy material. Unlimited comedy. When we do the Daily Nationalist on Friday, we're always looking for lighthearted topics. When we get Liz Truss as British prime minister, we are not going to be short of lighthearted topics, except she's probably going to wind up, you know, pushing Britain into war. Article I'm bringing today from RT is titled "Liz Truss Claims to Be an Insurgent." I'm thinking along the lines of ISIS. But anyway, the byline is: the straight-talking Yorkshire woman wants to build on Brexit and review the Bank of England's mandate. Tory leadership candidate and potential prime minister Liz. By the way, I'm very tempted to read this with my fake British accent. Tory leadership candidate and potential prime minister Liz Truss says that – I'm not going to do that – says that while she is not, quote unquote, the slickest presenter, understatement of the year, she is straight-talking Yorkshire woman who does not take no – who does not take no for an answer. In an interview on Friday with The Telegraph, Truss, who now serves as foreign secretary, said she sees herself as an insurgent candidate who wants to make Britain a high-growth, high-productive powerhouse. Her promises of more than £30 billion in tax cuts, as well as her plan to increase defense spending and anti-Russia stance, are well known. However, she told The Telegraph, she has more big plans. Asked about inflation, Truss said she would conduct a review of the Bank of England's mandate. I believe it is right that inflation will come down because inflation was caused by a global supply shock. But it was exacerbated by monetary policy, she explained. I'm sure she knows all about that. The foreign secretary also said she plans to conduct a spending review. The best way to get welfare spending down is to help people get into work. And that's my priority. I've got to stop there just because I always have to take a breather in the middle of these stories because it's so wound up. How amazing. You know that Liz Truss is an expert in all these fields. I mean, if you're wanting to, if you look at the amazing work she's done in foreign policy, and your economy's tanking and you've got rapid inflation and everything's going down the toilet, you're going to turn to somebody and you can say, okay, well, who obviously knows their stuff? And you look at the job Liz Truss has done as foreign secretary. And I believe she's also the head of like the board of equity or some crap. I wasn't interested enough to look it up. Sorry. But you look at the amazing you look at the amazing job she's done in that area, how she stood up there that time with Lavrov and just, you know, shamed him with her breathtaking knowledge of, Russian geography and such. You look at that and you say, this is the person. This is the person that I want turning our economy around. She's just really amazing. Here in America, it's hard for me to grasp. It's hard for me to really comprehend that there is a conservative party somewhere on the face of the planet that's actually worse than the Republicans. But then I see Britain. It's like a shining light on the hill. It's like a shining example that, yes, the Tories are actually worse. The Tories are actually worse than the Republicans. You wouldn't think it was possible. But actually, they are. And I just had to laugh at this idea that she's going to review. She's going to review, like she's going to go up against the central bank. She's going to do that. Like, does anybody actually? I don't know how people in Britain really are. Obviously, I've never been. But I have to wonder if people are really and truly that stupid. You know, I don't know. Matt, what are your feelings? Are you a Liz Truss backer? Do you appreciate good foreign policy, now nationwide policy comedy, the level of comedy we're going to get with Liz Truss as Prime Minister of Britain?
Well, as you said, she's extremely attractive. And for that reason, I have trouble reading about her because I'm not really concentrating on the words and the syntax and the meaning. I'm just looking at pictures of her. So I don't know if this is a plan to fool the British population, because no one's actually going to be reading anything about it. They're just going to be looking at it. And that's really my main issue here. So I don't really know what I'm talking about. But, you know, I've been saying this for God knows how long, that it's deliberate that politicians are, in the West anyway, are incredibly ignorant. And it's been a steep decline. In America, the decline started after Nixon. Nixon was legitimately knowledgeable and a scholar of sorts on international affairs. That becomes a problem. That becomes a problem because Nixon separated from the regime. You know, the government and the regime are two very different things. the government can start doing its own thing. You know, Vietnam was the government doing something the regime didn't want done. And to make sure that that never happens again, you know, Trump was another one for a short time. To make sure that that never happens again, what's being promoted are these people. And you know the straight talking label is going to be used in every newspaper article from here on in. So she's making sure that these people are just front men. I think of, you know, the dementia patient. I think of Boris Yeltsin as your classic, you know, means that those with real power can function behind the scenes and just throw these people up as window dressing. And the brilliance there is that if something goes wrong, they could blame the politician, because people really think that governments have something to do with corporate investment decisions. In fact, it's the opposite. Government is a function of corporate investment decisions. They have no direct control over the economy. And you mentioned Truss talking about the banks. Yeah, it was the same thing with Bernie Sanders. He's going to break up the banks. And I said, with what? The state is totally dependent on bank financing. How if anything, the banks will break up the state. What entity is going to have – and the assumption is – and I think he knows this. The assumption is that most Americans think that government does control the economy. Government does control the banks. They've been taught by libertarians and Republicans for a long time. They're trying to get government out of the economy as if that's an independent entity that has its own interests. And that's what's going on here. She spouts these lines, not fully aware. Now, in this case, it might be true that she doesn't realize that the British state has no direct control or even barely influence over the Bank of England. Of course, the other way around is different. She just may not know that. I'm pretty sure Bernie Sanders did. She's trying to talk like Margaret Thatcher, but without that without that bearing and without that. No, Margaret Thatcher wasn't bad. She wasn't right or wrong on a lot of things, but she at least had some functional knowledge. So the real danger for the regime is getting government that will oppose them. And although that's a you know, you see what happened to Donald Trump for doing that. You see the mockery, the attacks, the assassination attempts, you know, refusal, the banning him from everything as president, deliberately disrupting campaign stops, which of course is not legal, and getting away with it. So that's what you do to someone who comes from the outside. Nixon, despite being a congressman, was like this. And it comes down to simply having the knowledge and being able to debate with these people. Well, the dementia patient can't do that. Hillary Clinton couldn't have done that. This woman can't do that. And Boris couldn't have done that. There's a tiny handful of politicians that actually could go up against entrenched interests and fight it out intellectually. But they can't. That means not only are they financially dependent on the regime, they're dependent on the regime for their information, for their speeches, for their point of view. When you, campaigns have nothing to do with reality. I have a long article on why I refuse to vote. And part of the argument is that what people vote on has nothing to do with the candidate. These are rhetorical devices that they throw out there, unaware of any of the moral problems with that. And they're voting for a media image, or really an image of an image. Beyond that, let alone that the politicians will have anything to do with policy later on. Politicians don't have a lot of power, but you get someone who has his own money, like Trump. You get someone who has independent knowledge of international affairs, like Nixon. The regime is in trouble. You just can't control people like that. And so they got rid of Nixon and tried to get rid of Trump using the same kind of silly arguments. But that's what it comes down to. And of course, with Nixon, they got the U.S. out of Vietnam. That was, you know, Johnson's war and the regime's war. The regime was opposed to the war, but Nixon was aware enough to cut the umbilical cord. The damage had already been done. You know, a front man, you know, would be told what to do. So you get a politician who actually knows what's going on. They're going to be impeached. They're going to be attacked. They may be shot. And when they're ignorant, they don't know any better. So they're starting to reflect the population as a whole. Although I think even the average educated guy in the street is more knowledgeable on foreign affairs than these people.
You know, I think she is going to be the Prime Minister of Britain. She's got 50% support, I think, and Rishi Sunak has got 30% support. And basically, the choice between the two of them gets given to the Conservative Party members. And the Conservative Party members, they're very different to the actual Conservative Party itself. I'm amazed that they continue to support the party. Most of them are very traditionalist-minded. And I don't think there's any way that they're going to vote for somebody who is not ethnically British to lead the Conservative Party. So, I mean, Rishi Sunak, he's done well to get as far as he has, but I really don't think that he is actually going to get voted in. And Liz Truss, I mean, she is so out for herself, and that's it. She will literally say anything to get what she wants. I mean, she got caught having an affair, I think, a while back. Just this week, she's writing in the Jewish News, talking about how difficult it is to prosecute Jew hatred, and she's going to, if she becomes Prime Minister, one of the first things she's going to do is start making anti-Semitism laws. So she knows the people that she needs to suck up to in order to get that position. She is just desperate to become Prime Minister, and I do think that when she does, that we will just see one calamity after another, as she makes one mistake after another, that she really isn't that far away from these sorts of things. I can recall her saying about Russian gas and saying, well, it's okay. We don't get any of our gas from Russia. We get all of our gas from Europe. Okay, well, where does Europe get their gas from? Of course, they get their gas from Russia. So if Russia's going to not be allowed to export their gas to Europe, then we're going to lose out on our gas as well. Things like that. She just doesn't actually see far further than the end of her own nose. And I think she was the leader for women and equalities. That's the qualifications she has for being Prime Minister. She was the leader of women and equalities. Grandpa, please do continue.
Well, I noticed, I hate to point this out, but I noticed, Sven, you did dodge the obvious question of Liz Truss's hotness. So just to keep y'all distracted further, just visualize Liz Truss and Nancy Pelosi mud wrestling match. Truss considers herself more radical than her competitor, former Chancellor Rishi Sunak, when it comes to building on Brexit. Even though she's a former Remainer, Truss pointed to the trade deal she has helped secure over the past few years and noted that she already has the support of some prominent Brexiteers. She pledged to ensure that decisions on the future of more than 2,000 EU laws, which were adopted in the past by the UK, will be made by the end of next year. Sunak has made a similar promise. I'm a great believer in deadlines because that's what motivates people to get things done. Note here, not competence, not having original good ideas, but deadlines. You see, that's what's going to get things done. The foreign secretary denied reports that outgoing Prime Minister Boris Johnson backs her bid. He's not backing any candidate, she said. According to the latest YouGov poll, 31% of Tory members plan to vote for Sunak and 49% for Truss, who holds sizable advantages in trustworthiness and liability. Almost made a slip, but I would have still been right. And ability to lead the party. The survey was conducted on July 20th through 21st with 730 Conservative Party members. The winner will be announced on September 5th after a postal vote of approximately 150,000 Tory members. And like I say, I mean, it's not like I know everything, the ins and outs of British politics. And I just keep thinking when I look at how absolutely awful the Tories are, I mean, I have to think, you know, how really, really bad must Labour be then that they cannot capitalize. I mean, they're going to have Liz Truss. This is going to be a walking disaster. And like I say, it's going to be full of comedic material, but she is so at the front lines of pushing this war with what's going to amount to Russia and China. And for the British people, it is a very bad thing because you have this mindset among a lot of these politicians and whatnot. It seems like this mindset where I always say Britain, you know, is LARPing now. It's basically almost an irrelevant island nation. I'm not trying to be insulting, but I mean, it's basically an almost irrelevant island nation that's still LARPing like it's an empire. I mean, really, who is more relevant on the world stage, Great Britain or Japan? I mean, if you really get down to facts, but they go around, it's like Great Britain goes around and LARPs like it's still an empire and the world trembles at the thought of the mighty British Empire. But I mean, it's just, I'm sorry, it's kind of sad. But unfortunately, when you couple that with a warmongering lunatic and a complete incompetent like Liz Truss, it could very well spell a lesson or a, example, for disaster recipe. There, I finally got to spit out recipe for disaster. To my final pass around there, Matt, Liz Truss, Nancy Pelosi, mud wrestling match, pay-per-view, buddy. It's time to scrape up the money and put it in. Place your bets.
I'll put a second mortgage on my house to be able to watch that. I really don't have anything to say because, you know, that image is in my mind. It's not going anywhere anytime soon. Although I do think that something like that should be spoken to our monks, especially during Lent, because they'll never have another impure thought for the rest of their lives. They'll be saints automatically in that respect. I know, well, you know, you talked about the relevance of Britain, and I have my own opinions. You know, this is the 40th anniversary of the war in the Falkland Islands. And there is no, I have heard it from many people, that Britain could never put together a flotilla like that today. In fact, even prior to 1982, the state was engaged in draconian cuts to the Navy, especially. The Falklands War only gave, which, you know, and I have a paper on this, the Argentinians almost completely destroyed that flotilla. Why they gave up is a separate issue. Not only could they not do that today, people have to have something to fight for. You know, what kind of a speech could she give to soldiers in the field anywhere, or anyone for that matter? You know, she doesn't understand the first thing about things like, you know, the Falkland Islands or pieces of the British Empire that are still left, or the Commonwealth, or the monarchy, or anything like that. But my only hope here now is that as this gets worse and worse, and as more and more incompetent people come to power, or, you know, end up as window dressing, that there'll be alternative institutions developing. Because now you have even mainstream Republicans starting to notice that the system that they love so much is simply doesn't exist. There's no point in being involved in a system that's already geared for your destruction. You know, my concern for a long time is building of alternative institutions, not just political but economic ones, very quietly at the local level. And I think today, more than any other time, this is there's fertile ground for this. There's enough people that now have figured out that they just can't read newspapers anymore. They just can't watch TV anymore. They certainly can't read archaeological journals anymore without being preached to. So there could be a silver lining here. The other silver lining is that the regime, in terms of its corporate and academic rulers, media rulers, will come out in the open because they don't feel there's any real opposition to them. Politicians will be exposed as complete fraud and spokesmen for much more powerful interests. And most people don't even know their names. You know, the CEO of Vanguard. I mean, this is, you know, beyond them. So I'm trying to see white pills here with you just mocking the incompetence of these people. And when you have mainstream people starting to mock the incompetence of these people, that's a hopeful sign. As always, it's determined minorities, usually tiny minorities, that make history, not the masses. And as this gets worse and worse, and the exposure of the regime and the monopoly gets more and more clear, this may be an opportunity to really put together a political movement necessarily, but a movement at the local level to start building our own institutions.
I think, you know, maybe we're being a little bit harsh on Liz Truss here. I mean, come on, she's not quite as bad a looking as Theresa May, is she? And I do think it is going to be rather like Theresa May's premiership, because like Theresa May, she was a Remainer. Liz Truss didn't actually want to leave the EU. So we're going to have somebody that didn't want to leave the EU, that is going to be leading the country, whose main qualification is leading women's and equalities minister, and who knows nothing about history, nothing about geography. What could possibly go wrong with all the troubles that we have in the world at the moment when we've got somebody like Liz Truss at the helm? Well, Matt, I know you've got a Paul Craig Roberts editorial that you wanted to bring to our attention. Do you want to get into that now?
Well, this actually fits in perfectly with what we're talking about. that when you have non-existent leadership, it doesn't create a leadership void. It just means that those behind the scenes now run things without any real interference. This is an editorial, not technically a news story, but it does deal, of course, with very recent events. And the title is, "It is only a nanosecond to Armageddon." Now, if there is any area where political leadership is needed, it's to keep a nuclear war from happening. Now, I grew up in the 80s at a time where nuclear war was considered the worst possible thing. The anti-nuke movement was ginormous in America, Germany especially, violent protests against American weapons in Central Europe. And the concept of a nuclear arms race was considered just the most irrational possible thing. Now, because of the nature of what they consider the enemy, nuclear war is actually on the table. They went from condemning nuclear weapons to loudly promoting it over the space of 40 years. And the only difference is that these people are now, well, two things. They're fighting nationalist, Eurasianist governments that are illiberal. And the U.S. has long since declined in its international influence and reputation and even the ability to project military force. Now, we have spoken of this before. And one of the reasons I like Paul Craig Roberts so much is that he is a rare insider. He was the assistant secretary of the Treasury in the Reagan administration. And it's very rare to find someone like that with a PhD in economics to turn to our side. And he most certainly is with that kind of authority. Now, we've spoken about the nuclear primacy doctrine recently developed by the Pentagon and the U.S. government. And in that document, which I've read more than once now, it's considered nuclear war is considered a certain option and something that can be won, which every politician in the 80s said is impossible. They actually accept there is a doctrine of, quote, acceptable levels of destruction in America in a nuclear war against Russia or China. And it's acceptable, as this doctrine says, only if the U.S. wins. So they could vaporize cities in self-defense. And so long as the regime survives and is able to take over what's left of Europe and Asia, it's an acceptable thing. This would have been unspeakable and unthinkable 40, 50 years ago. This comes out of the RAND Corporation. Now, we know what the RAND Corporation is. It is a government finance agency closely connected with the U.S. Army. And this doctrine, and the RAND Corporation does have an option in their publications in this matter, that between 20 and 25 to 2030, there is a plan, or at least a very clear option, to use first strike capability against Russia and or China, although in this particular case, it's China. That the U.S., at least for now, or at least they claim, has nuclear supremacy, and that's why it should be this is the time, this is the window. Afterwards, it's a different story. Now, they're claiming that, you know, the missile shield is sufficient. The U.S. won't be too badly dead. There'll be a few million killed, but nothing too awful. And we've spoken on this show before about the elite buying and building underground bunkers. Now, it's still going to be very inconvenient for them underground, but that's a huge growth industry in the 1% is underground bunkers, private security, et cetera. But the assumptions here that a nuclear war against China is winnable assumes that the U.S. will be able to hit the Chinese nuclear weapons so fast that they won't be able to respond. And in fact, as he says, the assumption is that China will accept defeat rather than use nuclear weapons in retaliation, which is an absurd assumption. The war plans against Russia and China now are underway. This isn't something that the U.S. military, at least, has been shy about talking about, that the U.S. assumes still this bubble that they live in, the assumption that the U.S. has supremacy and military forces, which is ridiculous. The Chinese just developed, as we've spoken of, the Dong-5 missile that can destroy an aircraft carrier with one hit from 800 miles away. And, of course, the technology comes from Russia. The whole carrier unit now is obsolete. even the huge battleship is probably obsolete right now, because there is a missile system that could destroy it. And in a war against China, solely for those two reasons I mentioned, he also notes that Russia has to stay out of it. That's the assumption. Now, to think that the Russians are simply going to allow this to happen, you know, the first use of nuclear weapons to the point where no one can respond, is absurd. So you have two wild assumptions here. Assumption number one is that China is going to admit defeat, not use nuclear weapons in return, or couldn't use weapons in return. And number two, that's just going to be Peking versus Washington and nothing else. Now, he goes on to criticize Putin over something, and I think he has a point here, where he says that the militancy of Russia against the U.S. is always being blunt. He talks about the refusal to see the U.S. as crazy, and he means that clinically. That the neocon movement, the regime that controls foreign policy, is quite willing to and sees that it's perfectly normal to have a policy that says it's acceptable to have a few cities vaporized in the U.S. As a possibility in exchange for the resumption of American military and economic supremacy. The fact that China has long since been the number one economy in the world and actually produces things is terrifying to the U.S. But the criticism of Putin that and Paul Craig Roberts is very pro-Putin, his only criticism is that Putin doesn't seem to be able to wrap his head around this. It's really hard to accept that a major empire is run by people who are clinically, they're sociopathic. They don't care who has to die. And it doesn't make any difference whether the U.S. could even win or lose so long as somehow their opponents are destroyed. Now, he says here the Pentagon's doctrine doesn't say how many cities and how many millions of Americans are among the acceptable levels of destruction. But if you want proof that this regime sees Americans as pure cannon fodder, here it is. And this whole thing is based on these assumptions that this is like 1960, that the U.S., China is a third world country and the U.S. is still the dominant power in the world. And he says, you see, the only importance in the ruling neoconservative ideology and doctrine is U.S. hegemony, not your life. For the neocons, so long as America rules over a wasteland devoid of life, we have won. Neocons are truly insane people, and they are in control of U.S. foreign and military policy. They are very embedded in the regime. They don't need to have government positions to control foreign policy. And this is the evidence of that. Acceptable losses, acceptable vaporization. Even if the world is almost completely destroyed, so long as the U.S. maintains some kind of supremacy, they've won. And it doesn't matter how many people have to die, and they say so explicitly from the Pentagon as well as the RAND report, which again is from the U.S. Army. And then, of course, he goes on to attack really the American population. And in this case, of course, because I never do that, but the idea that they can't, if Putin can't wrap his head around this, that neither can the American population. The bubble that we talk about still infects most of the population, especially your middle classes. They live, as he says, in a virtual world disconnected from all reality. As I've said 100 times, the U.S. has been in a depression for a long time, but no one knows it, despite seeing the evidence everywhere. And he talks about the unsophisticated understanding of the population, which is one of the reasons why these ridiculous politicians keep getting elected. Then he quotes someone that we've used before, Eric Zuse, showing the evidence, and I've read this before, that the U.S. does have, as its official doctrine, the possibility of conquering not just Russia, but Russia too. And that the opening battlefield, as he says, is in Ukraine. And again, he says this. He says the Kremlin is unable to get its mind around the fact that Washington is insane. Putin actually thought that Washington would accept Russia's military intervention in Ukraine as it was limited to the protection of the Donbass Russia. And, that's a stretch. But I understand what he's saying. But if most Americans can't wrap their head around the nature of the regime or even know that it exists, it's very hard even for a highly motivated and well-educated politician to do it. He still thinks somehow he's working with a basically fair and rational Western world, although that's probably long gone. And he says this. He says, why is this the case? The only answer I could come up with is that America's brainwashing of the Russian intellectual class during the Yeltsin years has made Russian leadership deaf, dumb, and blind. Yeah, Lavrov, Putin, they correctly understand the situation, but there's very little done about it. Apparently, the Kremlin is going to continue to sell the energy to NATO countries so that NATO can continue the war on Russia and still pay on this short-term debt. Why? I simply don't know. Russia was continuing to supply cheap fuel to Ukraine even when the government was overthrown and a violently anti-Russian clique was installed by the Americans. Putin seems to err on the side of caution. It seems that they grasp this stuff, but they don't grasp it enough to actually act on. Then he talks a bit about the historical matter here. And he's quoting this man, and he says, I have documented that the plan by America's government was instead to fool Russia's government under Gorbachev to believe that America ended the Cold War on our side at the same time when Russia ended its side of the Cold War in 1991, but that the U.S. government was actually planning instead to surround Russia by increasing NATO right up to Russia's border. And as always, Paul Krugrabers can tear that apart. So what U.S. government, what does that mean? Is it the regime or is it the president? Now, we talked about politicians that are outside of the regime. They've made their peace with pieces of it, but they are independent of it. They're not dependent on it. And he talks about Reagan as being one of these people, at least for a while. And he mentions that President Reagan, of course, he knew the guy. He worked in the Reagan administration. He wanted to end, not win, the Cold War. He even went so far as to form secret committees to mobilize the CIA and get independent understandings of that U.S. would lose an arms race if it used to bring Russia with their broken economy into the negotiating table. So the plan was once the supply side policy eliminated in the Carter administration with stagflation, America's restored economy would bury Russia's broken and unrepairable economy in an arms race. So the point here is not to destroy the place or invade the place or break it. It was to bring Gorbachev to the negotiating table to end the Cold War. So if Reagan was interested in dismantling the Cold War at a certain point, without an enemy, the CIA's budget, along with the military security complex's budget, would be defenseless at their high level. And he does say Ronald Reagan, again, he was in the administration, was an outsider to the Republican establishment. That establishment was represented by George H.W. Bush, who was CIA director. And he was seen as a challenge to the regime. You know, political parties are creations of the regime. They're mouthpieces for it. That goes for any political faction. Factions are largely commodities that the media creates. And, you know, he's right to talk about the nature of this system. Political parties are concerned with power and control, not with the national interest. And Reagan was challenging that. And of course, as soon as Reagan was gone, that was completely overthrown. People on the right tend to not understand the left, including the neocons. They just want to be left alone, not realizing that that never works, because a militant movement constantly within a revolutionary mode will always defeat an object at rest. And as far as warfare is concerned, you know, so he's trying to say this was not the Republican concept in the 1980s. It's become both parties' concept, however, in today. That is to say that a nuclear war, the conquest of Russia and China and the destruction of their economies is actually a war that the U.S. can pull off, can win. And of course, any retaliation, if it happens at all, will lead to a few million American deaths, but that's acceptable. So, you know, people are wondering, how can the U.S., without the economy, without the military force, without the national unity, without all the prerequisites of a successful war, picking wars directly, not just with Russia, but with China too, at the same time, especially over the Taiwan issue. The U.S. couldn't defeat one of those. I mean, the U.S. lost to the Taliban. The U.S. couldn't defeat one of those, let alone both. Well, this is your answer. First of all, you're not dealing with reason. You're dealing with complete unreason. That's the point.
Completely unreasonable behavior all around. It does seem to me as if Putin is being particularly patient, and all he has to do is just sit back and wait and keep watching the mistakes that the rest of the world makes, especially with these sanctions. Inflation's going at a rate of about 10%, I think, here in Britain. It's 15% in the countries surrounding this Ukraine thing.
It's not to say that Paul Craig Roberts doesn't have a legitimate point. He does. You know, Putin doesn't seem, he still wants to be a part. He wants to do his own thing and have his own ideological movement in that part of the world, which is what I support, of course. But he doesn't seem to realize just how completely disconnected it is from the Western ideology. And all his speeches, he talks about how he can be a part of the Western structure, but on his own terms. That's not how it works. That's not how these people work. And I ended it. You know, why is the U.S. involved trying to pick a war with two superpowers at the same time? And this is the reason. There is no reason here. He says they're insane. They're sociopathic. They have severe mental illnesses. They're in a bubble. They don't understand reality. The concept of Americans being vaporized is an acceptable policy if it means the victory of the U.S. abroad. So even nuclear deterrence doesn't work with these people. This is a brand new phenomenon. It did not exist in the 1980s. And that's his point here. This is a brand new phenomenon of nuclear imperialism. And they're willing to lose millions so long as the Russians and Chinese lose more. That's what it comes down to.
Well, it's just about power, isn't it? It's who can get the most power. Instead of having a government that is supposed to be looking out for the best interests of the people, it's a government whose main role is to gain as much power for itself as possible and to weaken the power that these other governments have and that these other countries have. I mean, the whole political system has become warped. At least that's the way that I see it. You know, having that power has become all important, more important than anything else. And that's why they're willing to give up American cities. And so long as at the end of it, they win, it doesn't matter if they give up all these American cities, because they don't have that link to the people anymore. It's not part of their family. I mean, if it was part of Biden's family that was going to get blown up, then I'm sure they would think differently. But they don't. It's American cities, multicultural cities. They're just numbers. They're just people, as we were talking about before, raceless people, no identity. So you can afford to lose a few people, can't you? If the name of the game is to win, and that's all that it has become about. I mean, that's what politics is now, isn't it? It's no longer about doing what's best for a people group and having a system of politics and governance which is going to make life better for the next generation. It's just all about increasing the power that you have and weakening the power that these other groups have. And I mean, maybe that's the way things are supposed to work on the world stage, but not within the country itself. I mean, it should be that the people's lives are sacrosanct. I mean, where does common sense step in and say, well, hang on a minute, you know, isn't this a bit of a big risk that you're taking here, that you're going to end up with nuclear fallout, with countries blown up in America, and that seen as an acceptable risk to take? Do you think Putin sees that as an acceptable risk to take in Russia, Matt?
No, but neither did the Soviets. You know, they had tens of millions in camps working them to death, but in no way were they going to risk this. And for a long time, the Soviets had nuclear supremacy. They're putting an awful lot of faith in their missile shield, even though the Russian version is far superior, as if the Russians don't know how to penetrate that shield if necessary. That's, you know, all that military thinks about. They've been planning this for a long time. But in no way is any faction in Russian politics interested in this. And that's exactly Paul's point, because Putin still has to make that extra step where he doesn't grasp the level of the sociopathy that the American establishment has.
Grandpa, are you there? You got any thoughts on that?
Well, there's a lot to unpack. I've been sitting here madly jotting down my thoughts and notes as we've gone along, so they're going to come out kind of random. I'm sorry, because I've got like this long list here. You know, the irrationality of it is Dr. Johnson's pointed to. I always remember, and I believe it was so long ago, I'm having to remember off the top of my head, but it was during the second Bush administration. And I believe it was something I read, as I recall, by former Secretary of State under the first Bush, James Baker. And he referred to the neocons as, quote unquote, the crazies. And he said, you know, back during the first Bush administration, said, one of our primary jobs was, he said, these people were around, but one of our primary jobs was to keep the crazies out. You know, you kept them out on the fringe because, you know, people like John Bolton and stuff that were just always wanting war with everybody all the time. He said, we kept the crazies out. And he said, now, and this was, again, during the second Bush administration, says, I look around and the crazies are in charge. It's just kind of aghast at that. Now, one of the things I find amazing about the Russian-China, the Pentagon did a study and in war gaming, and they did a war gaming with a conflict, two-front conflict, U.S. against Russian-China. Unsurprisingly, it came out that there was absolutely no way the U.S. could win, and in fact, the conflict would be lost in very short order. So after this study and war gaming, they said there's no way we can do that, so what we have to do, of course, you know, peace never seems to be an option with these people. And so what we have to do is we have to take one out and then focus on the second. Now, obviously, that was the plan. The plan was to get Russia in, bogged down in the Ukraine. These sanctions were supposed to collapse the Russian economy. It would cause civil unrest. Putin would be driven from power. And Russia would basically become a failed state. Then they could move on to China. Now, obviously, the first step of the plan didn't work. The sanctions have absolutely failed, and Russia's doing fine economically. So the first prerequisite to their plan failed. Now, a normal person, not a crazy person, would sit around and go, well, wait a minute, we're going to have to back up here. But they obviously don't have a backup plan. So now they're moving forward with antagonizing China as if it worked. You know, they're moving forward with, okay, now we're ready to move on to the China phase of the plan, except for the prerequisite for that to have any chance of succeeding, which was Russia basically falling apart, that didn't work. But they don't have another plan. They don't have a backup plan. These people are crazy, but they're also kind of stupid. And so they're just moving forward now, and it's going to cause the very problem that the Pentagon warned about, that there's no way. There's no way to win a simultaneous two-front war against the deal. Now, when you read U.S. propaganda, and there's so much of it, whenever the topic of nuclear war comes up, they always try to insinuate that it would be Russia and or China who would do it first. You know, but that's just silly. As we've discussed here, there's no way the U.S. can beat Russia or China, much less both at the same time. It would be the U.S. that would have to resort to nuclear war. And, you know, if you're going to stick with history, the only country that actually has used nuclear weapons is the U.S. Propaganda that keeps the masses, the people, you know, kind of just oblivious to this thing. This whole idea of missile defense, that, you know, we have this umbrella and we can't be hit, that this is fantasy. I'm sorry. This notion that the U.S. has this impenetrable missile defense. You know, I'm just a regular guy. I'm not an academic. I'm not well studied. But I mean, if you read or look into any of this stuff, you realize very quickly that the idea that the U.S. is like impenetrable from nuclear weapons is just a fantasy that's given to the people. Now, for instance, the Russians have their intercontinental ballistic missiles. They basically go up more or less into space. They drop down. Now, instead of coming down, because the whole U.S. defense missile strategy is you can shoot their missile with your missile. Well, this thing, when it drops back in the atmosphere, it pops the head open and releases all of these multiple. They have one missile that can release enough nuclear warheads to destroy the state of Texas. And guess what? While these warheads are coming down, they can steer them. They can maneuver them around, and they're fairly small. There's absolutely no way to defend against that. They're not going to tell the people that, because people will be like, hey, wait, I don't really want to be vaporized. I have the question that if they, you know, they always act like if America has to be hit, it will be nuclear weapons. Now, I don't know, but I would guess that this, for instance, this Russian missile, if they can arm it with nukes, they can arm it with conventional weapons. And they're very accurate. It's not like we just have to aim for a city. So you could have a situation to where, oh, well, look, the Lockheed Martin plant just got hit by a large conventional Russian bomb and blown to smithereens. Who's going to rebuild that? Who's going to retrain the people to rearm, you know, start building these planes and whatnot? Who's going to do that? Like, it's like nobody in these positions actually thinks these things through. Now, as to Putin's statements and such, it is kind of frustrating because, you know, they act as though they can still act in good faith. Now, you contrast this with China's statements, because here as of late, China came out and basically said, look, we're done. We know there's no point in even talking to these people because they'll tell you one thing to your face and then turn around and do something else. You can't negotiate with these people in good faith. It's kind of like how I read a story yesterday. Macron's running around now and trying to get the Iranians to basically recommit to that nuclear deal that Trump tore up. And, or the lunacy of when Trump went over and tried to get North Korea after doing that, Trump went over and tried to get North Korea to sign another deal. Everybody on the planet knows you can't make a deal with these people. There's no point in even talking to them. They'll tell you one thing and then fly right back home and do the exact opposite and act like it has nothing to do. Pelosi's planning a trip to Taiwan, and China has said, you better not. We might even take military action. And now they're scrambling around in Washington. I was reading this morning. They're scrambling around in Washington trying to decide whether the Chinese are bluffing or not. You know, they assume because they bluff, because they lie, everybody else is doing the same thing. I too have been struggling with the idea. Why does Russia keep selling gas? Why did they just cut the damn gas off? You know, I mean, we honor our contracts, and it just is mind-boggling. It's like, just collapse Europe's economy. They're doing all of these hostile actions towards you. They're trying to collapse your economy. They're trying to collapse your government. They're trying to harm your people. You know, I think it would be fair to retaliate by shutting the gas off. And I've pondered this for a long time. Why are they doing this? Why are the Russians so slow to shut the gas off, to, you know, just keep saying we're honoring our contracts with people who refuse to honor anything on their side of the table? And the only thing I can come up with is one of the things that's collapsing the U.S. ability to use the dollar as a global reserve currency is these sanctions, because they've weaponized the banking system. They've weaponized the dollar. They're just seizing Russian assets. They're just rando Russian people. They're just taking their stuff. They're just acting completely lawlessly. And this is collapsing. There's a reason why so many countries now are just like fleeing from the U.S. The U.S. shows up in these smaller countries and tries to throw their weight around. And they're like, yeah, no, thank you. You know, because everybody now has realized, because the U.S. has demonstrated that you can't do anything in good faith with these people. And they'll just go outside the law and just steal your stuff. And I think Russia is trying to make it a point that they're in a position they can be trusted. They're thinking, I think some of this is long-term thinking, that as the U.S. crumbles, the empire crumbles, that, you know, people look at Russia and say, well, you know what? Through all of that, they honored their deals. They honored their contracts. So we can do business with these people and we can trust them. That's the only thinking. That's the only reasoning I can apply to that. So I'll hand it back to you, Sven.
Yeah, I think you're right there. I think that's it. They're honorable people. They want to be seen as being honorable. What we have going on in the West, though, is just complete incompetence. I'm amazed that people are still saying, oh, it's all part of the plan. It's all part of the Great Reset. They're crashing the economies. And, well, why would you really want to crash your economy? Why would you want to set inflation at 10% where there's a chance that there's going to be food riots? There's a chance that there's going to be riots because of the fuel costs so much to pay for. I mean, what was it that set off that Kazakhstan revolution a while back? And it was the cost of fuel. I mean, the last thing you want is upset within your own country because people are too hungry or they can't afford fuel. And yet that's what our governments are doing. They're setting the conditions so that it's possible that there could be some uprising, some discontent. You know, I mean, it's just obvious that that's going to happen when you've got fuel prices that are as high as they are. And I can't see any reason for doing that other than incompetence. it does seem to be incompetence. And instead of realizing what's going on and saying, well, maybe we should reassess things a little bit here, they're just still charging on full steam ahead. Let's go and wind China up. We'll send Nancy Pelosi off to Taiwan. We'll tell Zelensky not to make peace with Putin. We'll tell him to keep ignoring all these overtures for peace that Russia keeps making. I mean, they just keep heading in the same direction, which is just the direction of chaos and the collapse of the American empire. And I guess that's why Russia is just sitting back and waiting for it to happen. And so is China. Matt, what are your final thoughts on all of this and these points that myself and Grandpa have raised?
You know, every time we do one of these roundtables, we end up talking about the bubble. You know, bad policy comes from constructing an enemy rather than studying an enemy. They've constructed the Russo-Chinese alliance as primitive, totalitarian, unpopular, etc. Still have third world militaries, still, you know, recovering from, and that's a construction that exists in their minds. And of course, it makes the regime feel good about itself because now we are the peacemaker. We're the rules-based center of the international order. I've said it before, policymakers in and out of the regime don't seem to comprehend that the U.S. is very fragile, that it doesn't have the military strength anymore, it doesn't have the money. It's dependent on a handful of banks that Russia and China have, and militarily, pulled ahead of the U.S. This is something that at least that generation in power now, they can't they either can't accept or they won't accept. So they make these policies on the grounds that that's who they're fighting. And it's a legitimate field in international relations, constructivism, where the enemy is created in their minds rather than studied and understood. That's what's happening here.
Any final thoughts on that, Grandpa?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's exactly it. And they do live in a bubble. And again, it's like they don't have a plan B. You know, when people talk about the Great Reset and, you know, well, if you're going to get into a global conflict with Russia and China, why would you collapse your economy? Well, I think because part of that is because, you know, this is behind schedule. I think some of this is why they were so adamantly just hysterical, upset about Trump, is because he threw the schedule off. This was all supposed to be laid out. You know, the steps were supposed to be taken several years ago, and he threw things behind schedule. And, you know, they were supposed to already basically have Russia eliminated, China on the ropes, and now we can collapse the economy and do the Great Reset. But see, none of those other things have happened, and they don't have a plan B, and they're not smart enough to think up a plan B. So they're just going forward with the plan as if, well, it'll all work out somehow. It really is. They live in a bubble, and in the end, that breeds even more incompetence. And we're seeing that. We're seeing that play out now. And unfortunately, even though it'll be great comedic material in the short term, in the long term, it's going to be a rough haul. I mean, we're talking about wars, and that always means people die, usually people that have nothing to do with instigating them. But sadly, it seems to be where we're heading, and it seems pretty much inevitable.
Well, at least we still have Christian civilization there in the East. Russia seems to be standing up for traditional values. Obviously, they not as much as we do as ethno-nationalists, but they're still standing up for traditional values. So while things are collapsing in the West, things do seem to be rising in the East. Civilization now, I think, is going to be a central part of Russia and the Russian Federation. I think it's going to move from Europe over to there while the American Empire collapses. Well, I think we should leave that here for today then. I've enjoyed that. I'm sure that our listeners have as well. Thank you very much for coming on today, Grandpa. Thank you very much for coming on today, Dr. Johnson. I hope you will both join us again for another roundtable later on in the year. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.
When that's the roundtable, we dance where we're able.